Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The economy just can't make up its mind whether we're in a recovery. One month, yeah, it looks like housing might be getting better. The next, people stopped buying stuff. When will a trend stay a trend? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by LendingTree, providing up to 4 loan offers from a network of lenders. Learn more at LendingTree.com or 1-800-555-8733. And by Reputation.com, monitoring, protecting, and improving reputations online while deleting personal data from the Internet. Reputation.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Wednesday. It is the 4th day of May. So if you thought the economy was on the mend, the numbers had another idea today. The service sector grew slowly in April, and private payrolls rose less than expected, more signs that the recovery is still in start and stop mode. But as Marketplace's Elisa Roth tells us, some observers think today's headlines are just a few more bumps in the road.
ADP, which is a payroll processing company, says the economy only added 179,000 private sector jobs in April. It's about 19,000 fewer than analysts were predicting. The disappointing jobs numbers dovetail with a report from a group that tracks non-manufacturing activity in the U.S. economy. The Institute for Supply Management says the service sector grew at its slowest rate since last summer. Together, the two reports suggest the economy and the recovery are still weak.
The higher gasoline prices seem to have knocked back consumer confidence and probably did take a bite out of consumer spending.
Stuart Hoffman is chief economist at PNC Financial Services Group. He says bad weather caused slow growth in the first quarter, and it did again in April.
Certainly the tornadoes are going to mess up some of the data we've seen in the latter part of April. Housing, though, perennially is weak.
He says these bumps are serious, but they don't pose a long-term threat to growth. Beth Ann Bovino is a senior economist at Standard & Poor's. She says this recovery is taking longer than usual. In the first year after a recession, growth has been more like 5%. In 2010, it was around 3%, and she thinks we're looking at the same for this year.
We had been saying overall that this was a half-speed recovery. It's just going to be a little bit slower than even that half-speed.
She doesn't think the recovery has been derailed, though. If the U.S. can keep growing 3% for a few more years, we'll be okay. We'll get a better idea of how the employment picture is progressing on Friday when the government reports its April jobs numbers. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Today, a House committee voted to change the structure of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. That's the new agency that is supposed to protect people from things like exploding mortgages and onerous credit card terms. Under the Dodd-Frank financial reform law, it was to be headed by one person, but Republicans want it to be run by a committee instead. Marketplace's John Dimsdale has more from Washington.
When the Financial Protection Bureau was fiercely debated last summer, sponsors of the bill, like Massachusetts Democrat Barney Frank, rejected the idea of the traditional 3- or 5-member commission to decide regulations.
We made a conscious decision to have a single director.
Frank says because the Senate is asked to confirm politically balanced commissions, like the Federal Communications Commission or the Securities and Exchange Commission, the usual result of their votes is stalemate.
The history of those commission agencies, given the politicization of the confirmation process, is that much of the time they're out of commission.
But advocates of a commission say decisions reached by building consensus among several appointees are more effective. Barbara Matthews is a former staffer for both Congress and Treasury, now with the consulting firm BCM International Regulatory Analytics.
The more people you have in a room dealing with difficult issues, the more your opportunity for getting a good decision exists.
And when there's just one director, it will change with each new president, creating more radical swings in regulations, says Columbia law professor Peter Strauss.
The multi-member commission, because its membership changes only gradually, is much more likely to hold a steadier middle course.
And that makes the one director nominated by the president a much tougher sell on Capitol Hill. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
We know all that glitters is not gold, but is gold the new dollar? Countries around the world have been gobbling up bullion in recent years as a form of financial security, and the latest is Mexico. Mexico's central bank bought about $4.5 billion worth of gold in February and March, and as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports, it's helping to push gold to record highs.
Gold is becoming the security blanket for central banks around the world. In February and March, Mexico's central bank bought almost 100 tons of gold. Jong Park is an equity analyst at Morningstar. He says these kinds of purchases have a big impact on gold prices, which are now trading near a record high of $1,500 a troy ounce.
Central banks are definitely a huge swing player in the market, given that they tend to buy in the order of hundreds of tons at a time.
Park thinks prices will fall in the next couple years as individual investors turn away from gold. But some other market types say demand for gold is not going away. Olivier Garay is CEO of Casey Research, which does investment research and has direct investments in gold. He points to purchases by India and others as an international trend.
We have Russia buying gold. We have most countries in South America. China, which is the largest producer of gold, is no longer exporting gold. It has doubled its reserves in the last 6 years. What it says is that those countries really are no longer trusting the major paper currencies, and specifically the U.S. dollars.
Some countries, including China, have called for the creation of a new international currency. But Gray doubts that gold could serve as the basis for a currency. He says central banks are accustomed to printing money whenever they want, and you can't print gold. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Comedy gold is what every would-be humorist strives for, and it's what we pan for as an audience member at a stand-up club. It can also be as elusive as actual gold. So today, the streaming music service Pandora, the folks who allow you to basically design your own radio station, announced a way to create your own comedy club. Type in a comedian you like, a style, even a specific joke, and it builds a playlist, more accurately a set, based on your preferences. Tim Westergren is Pandora's founder.
If music suffers from ineffective promotion, I think comedy is even in tougher shape. So I think this could offer a really wonderful platform for comedians at all stages of their careers to find and develop new audiences.
Comedians will get royalties every time their material makes it into a set. Steve Hofstetter is one of Pandora's featured comedians, and he's hoping the recommendations bring a new audience.
I think if people like someone like a Bill Hicks or a George Carlin, obviously I don't consider myself in the same league as them. But in terms of the style and what I find funny, I think that they'll be more amenable to enjoying my stuff.
New Comedy on Wall Street has those sad economic figures Elisa gave us earlier helped send stocks lower. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Signs of economic trouble, namely in the job market, but corporate stocks had their best performance of the year in April. Profits are soaring. So why hasn't that translated into more hiring? That's the question commentator Robert Reich says we should be asking.
First quarter, corporate profits are way up, as is the stock market. But the U.S. economy has slowed to a crawl, a measly 1.8% annualized growth, down from over 3% last quarter. Real wages are also down. And despite more jobs, the percent of working-age Americans actually working remains as low as it was in the depths of the recession. How can big American corporations be doing so well and the economy so badly? Because their sales are booming abroad, and they're adding new jobs where their sales are. Caterpillar, for example, is going gangbusters outside the U.S., and over the past year has added 12,000 workers abroad. But its domestic workforce remains below pre-recession levels. Or look at GE, the bellwether of American corporations. 60% of its business is now coming from outside the U.S., and that's where 54% of its employees are. Almost half the sales of the S&P 500 are now overseas. The Commerce Department reports that in the past decade, American multinationals have eliminated almost 3 million jobs in the U.S. while adding more than 2 million abroad. So we've got big American corporations in a vigorous recovery that's raising stock prices, while the U.S. economy languishes. Which raises some basic questions. What is the American economy, and how is its success supposed to be measured? And why should big U.S. corporations, whose sales and employees and even investors are becoming more and more global, be called American companies anyway? And finally, why should the Supreme Court give these big global companies the First Amendment right to spend unlimited amounts of money on our elections? You see, we're relying on our elected officials for policies that help create jobs with good wages here in America, which isn't exactly the objective of these global enterprises.
Robert Reich served as Secretary of Labor under President Clinton. His most recent book is Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. Next week, David Frum. Send us your comments. Go to marketplace.org and click on Contact. $4.57 was the going rate in my neighborhood to fill up the tank over the weekend, and I'm pretty sure that is not the highest price in Los Angeles. Food is getting more expensive, too. But so far, those price spikes have not kicked off broad inflation in this country. In China, however, the overheated economy has triggered a troublesome inflationary cycle. And from fuel to smartphones, the price of everything is going up. Our China correspondent Rob Schmitz joins us from Shanghai to talk about it. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Tess.
So how are these rising prices affecting you?
Well, as a foreigner in China, I'm being hit with sort of a double whammy, the rising price of everything, plus China's currency has risen 5% on the dollar. So that means that over the past year, I've lost 5 cents for every dollar I spend here. And that's not too bad, but the price of food in China has risen 11% since last year, and that's a big jump. My wife and I were talking about this last night. We couldn't think of one restaurant we go to that hasn't overhauled its menu in the last few months. Everyone's raising prices. The Kung Pao chicken at the Hunan restaurant down the street is suddenly a dollar more than it was last year. The eggs we buy are now 20 cents more. I sort of feel like I'm an old timer complaining about prices of eggs in the good old days. But, you know, I'm reminiscing about prices from last year.
Right.
So for me, a foreigner in Shanghai, it's not that big of a deal. But for your average Chinese worker who's barely getting by and is living paycheck to paycheck, this is pretty serious.
Well, now that you've got me hungry, let's talk about those working Chinese. How are they dealing with this?
Well, I've noticed that my Chinese neighbors are changing their buying habits a little. Instead of heading to the new supermarket down the street, they're flocking to open-air markets now where they can bargain. And of course, you know, they're not buying as much. But you're seeing more families invite grandpa and grandma over for dinner to share meals. So a lot of these things that were commonplace in China for decades are starting to make a comeback. On the more serious side, 2 weeks ago here in Shanghai, truckers held protests that turned violent. And this was all because their incomes haven't kept pace with the price of fuel.
Wow. Well, Rob, what is the Chinese government saying it's going to do about this? I mean, you got to think they're a little worried.
Yeah. I mean, when inflation gets to the point where it's causing social unrest, that's definitely something that grabs the attention of China's government. Local governments set the minimum wage here in China, and they've been raising minimum wages by an average of 20% over the past couple of years. Yesterday, I spoke with a sanitation crew in Shanghai and asked them about inflation. They said it was a problem, but they told me the city had given them 2 pay raises this year, so they seem pretty content with that. Another thing the Chinese government is doing is 2 weeks ago, they passed a law that exempts anyone who makes less than $500 from income taxes, and that affects a lot of people. So the government is trying to work with people on this, and this test is where inflation affects you in the U.S.
How so? Draw a line for us.
Well, bottom line is this. Stuff in China isn't so cheap anymore. Chinese workers are demanding and getting better wages. Higher wages will be passed down to you, the American consumer. And all of a sudden, those cheap Chinese goods that were helping keep prices low in the U.S. are going to have higher price tags on them. And then, voila, you've got inflation. Not a great time for it either. The U.S. economy is still suffering from slow growth, high unemployment. This is definitely not a Chinese export anyone wants, but most economists agree it's coming your way.
All right. That's our Marketplace China correspondent, Rob Schmitz, joining us from Shanghai. Thanks so much, Rob.
Thanks, Tess.
Coming up, why organics and genetically modified crops may have a place in our food future.
Globally, the idea is it's going to be a big tent. There's big agriculture, small agriculture. There's room for all.
But first, let's do the numbers. That slowdown in the service sector and less hiring in April knocked markets off balance today. The Dow lost 83 points, 2/3% to end at 12,723. The Nasdaq shaved off 13 points, nearly 0.5% to close at 2828. And the S&P 500 lost 10 points, 2/3% to finish at 1347. Conagra Foods packed on 3% today. The company raised its bid for Ralcor Holdings. Ralcor owns the Post cereal brand. It gained nearly 5%. Kellogg fell a little more than 1% after higher costs pushed down first quarter earnings. Las Vegas Sands rolled snake eyes with shares down more than 7% today. The casino company's earnings missed estimates. The 10-year T-note gained, pushing the yield down to 3.22%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill, an international producer and marketer of food, agricultural, financial, and industrial products and services. Information at Cargill.com. And by Progressive Insurance, with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on mileage and safe driving habits. Learn more at Progressive.com. Entrepreneurship reporting is supported by Deluxe Corp, a marketing resource to 4 million small businesses, with logo and website design, search engine marketing, and more at deluxe.com/marketing. What does Tier 1 Capital have in common with a wedding cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
Here's a look at the Marketplace datebook for events coming up Thursday. President Obama is scheduled to make a trip to Ground Zero. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee holds a hearing to assess U.S. policy and its limits in Pakistan. And on May 5th, 1891, Andrew Carnegie's new music hall opened in New York City with a five-day music festival. The venue was later named Carnegie Hall. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdal. Just up the freeway, the Los Angeles Dodgers are struggling in the early weeks of the season. Their win-loss record is about even. And the team may lose more than games in the near future if it can't pay players. The hometown paper, the Los Angeles Times, is reporting that the team's owner, Frank McCourt, does not have enough money to make payroll at the end of the month. You may remember a couple of weeks ago, Major League Baseball announced it was taking control of the team and investigating its finances. Jennifer Collins reports on the latest Dodger blues.
Any chance you could spare $8 million? That's what the Dodgers need to pay players for the last 2 weeks of this month. Sports economist Brad Humphreys says this hardly ever happens.
Failing to make payroll is a pretty serious event.
Dodgers owner Frank McCourt borrowed heavily to buy the team. He's been through a nasty divorce that exposed reckless spending. The league's appointed a monitor for the team. McCourt's hoping the league will approve a deal with Fox TV Network for $3 billion over 17 years. Still, sports commentator John Weinbach says don't worry too much about the players.
What would happen if the Dodgers missed payroll is Major League Baseball would fund them, essentially taking money from all the other owners. So, in effect, every owner in Major League Baseball would be funding the L.A. Dodgers.
Weinbach says McCourt has seriously cut back spending on the team. Rodney Paul, sports economist at St. Bonaventure University, says that's sent the wrong message.
It's just that you don't want to have a team give the signal that we don't care about winning, right? As soon as you do that, most fans are not going to be able to justify spending the money to go out to the park.
There are reports the team's attendance is down 12%.
To be able to not have that be generated, I think, hurts not just the Dodgers, but the league overall. Television ratings, you know, ticket sales, et cetera, et cetera.
He says as baseball emerges from the economic downturn, it needs all the grand slams it can get. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
It's Wednesday, the time of the week to hear from you.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
Last week, we reported on record oil company profits and calls from politicians to cut subsidies to those corporations. Michael Myers-Juan of Wanacue, New Jersey, says we let big oil off too easy. He says American consumers are being gouged, plain and simple.
The cost of transportation, refining, labor, and all the other costs of doing business have either remained the same or gone down as American wages have been steadily reduced in terms of purchasing power. So there's nothing preventing the American oil companies from reducing their retail prices and maintaining a more or less constant profit per gallon, except greed.
We also reported that as some states strip public employee unions of bargaining rights, workers are opting to retire early to save their pension benefits. Kathy Hagen of Wayzata, Minnesota, works with companies afraid of losing decades of knowledge along with those older workers.
This is a huge issue for companies from a cost standpoint. And with four generations in the workplace, transferring knowledge is critical, but must be done in a way learners can take charge of their learning as well.
Also on the program, how cheap new gadgets help people spy on others. Michael Levy is chief of the computer crime section at the U.S. Attorney's Office in Philadelphia, and he wrote in with a reminder that there are laws against that sort of thing.
Intercepting the wire and electronic communications of another person is a felony, carrying up to 5 years in prison. Entering the email account or private parts of a social networking site account of another person is also a crime, carrying anywhere from 1 to 10 years in prison, depending on what one does inside the account.
Finally, a correction on pronouncing a word. Last week, we talked chilies and how climate change might affect consumption of the hot peppers. Michael Soulis of Portland, Oregon, wrote to say that we mispronounced habanero. It's actually just habanero. Unlike jalapeno, there is no squiggly line over the N. You can send us your comments. Just go to marketplace.org, no squiggly line. Or tweet us, or post on our Facebook page. The United Nations says 1 billion people go hungry on this planet each day. And the overall population is growing. Experts expect we'll top 9 billion by 2045. So the looming question is how to feed everyone with limited resources. This week, several major foundations, including Ford and Gates, launched a $3 million a year initiative aimed at figuring out how to come up with the food we need. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Adrian Hill looks at what the answer might involve and what it might not.
The farmers' markets in Los Angeles these days are piled high with organic strawberries and kale. To the contented shoppers, this is what the future should be: fruits and veggies grown on small farms nearby the city. But get over it. This isn't the future. Not if we want to feed everyone.
If you ask me point blank whether organic-based farming is better than conventional, my answer is no.
That's Columbia University's Pedro Sanchez.
There are just too many of us. We just need too many nutrients.
And those nutrients come from plants that need nutrients that organic fertilizers can't always provide.
It's like a bank account. You've got to have a positive balance.
And if you deposit only organics, he says,
you're going to go broke.
One reason experts say organic farming isn't the big scale answer.
Organic production tends to have somewhat lower yields compared to non-organics.
Mark Rosegrant is with the International Food Policy Research Institute, an organization focused on sustainable ways to end hunger. He says going all organic would require a whole lot more land. Organic farming is, Rosegrant says, a niche market. It's not bad per se, but
it's not an important part of the overall process to feed 9 billion people.
The Economist recently had a special issue on global food supplies. One piece ended with the thought that the reaction against commercial farming, with its dependence on chemicals, is, quote, a luxury of the rich. So what does the future of farming look like? Rosegrant thinks that genetically modified crops have to play a part, especially as pollution causes the planet to warm up.
I think we do think it's part of the toolbox going forward that, for example, to get some of the drought tolerance or other kinds of heat tolerance.
The future may also involve more creative farming.
We're in the middle of what used to be the El Toro Marine Basin, and we're on an airport, actually, and we're farming then in the open areas between the tarmac.
Eiji Kawamura is a third-generation farmer. He's also the former California Secretary of Agriculture. The afternoon sun bounces off concrete runways and rows of small organic yellow squash. Kawamura and his brother grow organic and conventional crops.
Globally, the idea is it's going to be a big tent. There's big agriculture, small agriculture. There's room for all.
When you grow lots of food in lots of ways in lots of places, Kawamura says, droughts and floods and bugs that chomp down on crops become less of a problem. The future may also involve eating differently.
We need to address what diet looks like in the developed world and what diet looks like in the developing world and how to sort of balance things out.
Mark Bittman is a food columnist for the New York Times and the author of the Food Matters cookbook. His mantra? More veggies, less meat. Animals take a lot more water and food to grow than plants.
We hear a lot about how the Chinese are eating more like us, but the reality is we need to be eating more like the Chinese.
For the billion underfed people in the world today, there are 1.5 billion that are overweight. That, too, needs to change, Bittman says, as we all start thinking more about what we eat. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
When do you buy organic? Adrienne asked each of her experts that question for their answers and to share yours. Head to marketplace.org. Marketplace is supported by Chevrolet, maker of the new Volt, which plugs in anywhere and goes everywhere. Available in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com. And by Putnam Investments, focused on finding opportunities one stock at a time. On the web at Putnam.com/large cap equity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism. And this final note, sometimes a dollar is just a dollar, and sometimes that greenback is like a Picasso. Art is what the dollar, 100,000 of them actually, will turn into at New York's Guggenheim Museum in a couple of weeks. The German artist Hans-Peter Feldman will pin 100,000 $1 bills to the gallery walls. The money is actually prize money from the Guggenheim. The museum says it is a statement about currency as a simple, everyday material instead of a symbol of capitalism. But it will revert quickly to a symbol of capitalism after the exhibition ends and Feldman puts the money right back into his bank account. And that is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 83 points, 2/3%. The Nasdaq shaved off 13 points, nearly 0.5%. And the S&P 500 lost 10 points, 2/3%. Vahan Balladooney, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Next time on this show, you can't talk college acceptance without talking waiting lists.
It's a classic case of hedging your bets. But, yeah, twice the size of your freshman class? Come on, that's crazy.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.